I want to read you guys a little story out of one of my favorite little books here. Just want you to sit back and listen for a second. That's what it says. Giants, Wizards, and Dwarfs was the game to play. Being left in charge of about 80 children, 7 to 10 years old, while their parents were off doing parenty things, I mustered my troops in the social hall of the church and explained the game. It's a large-scale version of rock, paper, scissors and involves some intellectual decision-making. But the real purpose of the game is to make a lot of noise and run around chasing people until nobody knows which side you're on or who's won. Organizing a room full of wired-up grade schoolers into two teams, explaining the rudiments of the game, achieving consensus on group identity, all this is no mean accomplishment. But we did it with good right will and we're ready to go. The excitement of the chase had reached critical mass. I yelled out, "You have to make a decision now. Which are you, a giant, a wizard, or a dwarf?" While the groups huddled in frenzied, whispered consultation, a tug came to my pants leg. A small child standing there looked up and asked in a small, concerned voice, "Where do the mermaids stand?" "Where do the mermaids stand?" A long pause, a very long pause. "Where do the mermaids stand?" said I. "Yes, you see, I am a mermaid." "There are no such thing as mermaids," I said. "Oh yes, I am one." She did not relate to being a giant, a wizard, or a dwarf. She knew her category, mermaid, and was not about to leave the game and go over and stand against the wall where the losers would stand. She intended to participate wherever mermaids fit into the scheme of things, without giving up dignity or identity. She took it for granted that there was a place for mermaids and that I would know just where that place was. Well, where do the mermaids stand? All the mermaids, I mean. All those who are different, all those who don't fit the norm, all those who do not accept the available boxes and pigeonholes. Answer that question and you can build a school or a nation or even a world on it. What was my answer at the moment? Every once in a while, I say the right thing. "The mermaids stand right here by the king of the sea," said I. Yes, right here by the king of fools, I thought in my mind. So we stand there hand in hand, reviewing the troops of wizards and giants and dwarfs as they rolled by in wild disarray. It's not true, by the way, that mermaids do not exist. I know at least one personally. I have held her hand. Isn't that a great story? Have you ever felt that way? Like you're one of the mermaids, you know, that you just don't seem to quite fit into what's going on around you? Ever felt like you've sort of missed the boat somewhere? You woke up one day and you had dreams and you had a world you were intending to live in and a person you were intending to be and things you were intending to do. And one day you woke up and realized life might have just passed you on by. Or maybe you got caught up in life and it kind of washed over you and now you're standing on the other side kind of going, "Who am I and why am I here? I don't know." Have you ever felt out of place? Have you ever felt like somehow you deeply hope and desire that there's something that's meaningful, important for you, that God has some place just for you in the world, but somehow it doesn't feel like it? Somehow it feels like you're in a world of giants and dwarfs and wizards and you're a little mermaid. Sometimes it feels that way in God's world, that you feel like you're the mermaid in God's world. Everybody has a fit, but maybe not you. The story we're about to jump into today is a story that should speak to your heart as it speaks to mine about what God is up to in our lives, in your life, and what he's doing. We're going to step into a story today as we travel through the Old Testament that is a beautiful picture of God taking a step back and showing us the bird's eye view that he gets to have when he's watching life unfold. You know when you're watching a movie sometimes, you get to see all these different scenes happening, either simultaneously or on different occasions, and the only person that knows what all the scenes are is you, the movie watcher, but the people in the movie that are in the story, they have no idea that while they're here struggling and having a tough time right over here in this scene over here, something's happening that's going to impact them in a huge way, and you know it's coming, but they don't, and you're all excited. That's exactly how this story plays out. And we're going to get to see a story right now as we step back and watch how God is at work on this planet in your life and mine as he brings everything together to play out the way it's supposed to play out and how important your scene is in that story. We are going to walk into the story of Esther this morning. It's a beautiful story. It's one of those great ones you've probably already heard. And it is one of the stories that speaks about life in the time that the Jews were in the middle of captivity. In fact, it is one of the only books, the only book we have that really speaks to what life was like under the Persian Empire. You remember as we travel through the Old Testament before we turn to the book of Esther, that the Jewish people were brought into captivity into Babylon, and then Babylon was taken over by Persia. We're now under the Persian Empire. Daniel's time is done. We've walked into the next few Persian kings. We're under a Persian king now, and this Persian king, it opens up in 483 BC in the book of Esther. He's been reigning for just a short period of time, about 3 years now, and as we open the book of Esther, we open there in 483 BC with a story that happens right there in what is now Persia, and in fact, in the winter palace of this man. So, would you turn with me to the book of Esther in your Bibles? If you don't have a Bible, under the chairs is a bunch of Bibles. Grab one of those, and you can turn there in them. If you have one of our Bibles, the book of Esther is on page 347. Now, in our Bibles here, the king that we're going to talk about is Xerxes. You'll see in a second. But just so you know, Ahasuerus is another name for Xerxes. In the historical chronicles, he is known as Ahasuerus. So some Bibles, like the, for instance, the New English Standard Version, will actually use his name, historical name, Ahasuerus, instead of Xerxes. Sometimes critics will use this to show that the book of Esther is not true, that Xerxes never existed. But as historians have dug in, they have discovered exactly who this man is. But we're going to call him Xerxes because that's what's in here as we read. So it says here in chapter 1, verse 1, this is what happened during the time of Xerxes, the Xerxes who ruled over 127 provinces stretching from India to Kush. Now, we open up with a story and a scene, okay? I'm going to jump around a bit, stay in the book of Esther. I'm going to touch base in different scenes because remember, we're watching a movie here and we're going to jump around a bit, so hang with me. First scene opens up. We open up in a scene where the king is having a huge banquet. As a matter of fact, more than a banquet. It says here a full 180 days he displayed the vast wealth that he had. For 180 days, he brought in parties and people and had all sorts of things displaying his power. Now, part of the reason why he's doing this is we find out in history that in fact in this year, over the next 4 years, this king is setting up a plan to go and attack Greece. He wants to have the Grecian Empire. So over the next 4 years, there's going to be a huge battle, if you will, with the Grecian Empire. And these 180 days line up with the very beginning of that campaign. So this would have been typical of the big celebrations that happen before a huge campaign is about to take place. Why? Because the king has to display to all the people how wealthy and powerful and unbelievable the nation is right now and how easy it's going to be for them to go in and take the Grecian Empire. Turns out, actually, by the way, side note, over the next 4 years, it's a disaster zone of a war for Xerxes, and the Grecians completely send them back home packing. So it didn't turn out so well for him, but they have this huge party. The Bible tells us in this passage that after he had been really happy with some wine, which translates into he was drunk, he was sitting there and he thinks, okay, you know what I'm going to do? I want to take this all the way. So he sends one of his eunuchs to get his wife, okay? And he says to Vashti, listen, get my wife, bring her out here, put her in a best robe, put a crown on her head. I want her to prance around in front of everybody and show everybody how beautiful she is and how powerful I am because she is the most beautiful woman on the planet. Now, we do not know why exactly what just happens. But as word is sent out, we find out that this is what Vashti says, okay? In verse 12 of chapter 1, but when the attendant delivered the king's command, Queen Vashti refused to come. Then the king became furious and burned with anger. See, at this particular moment, she comes in and she's told to come before the king. And the king goes, I want you to come do this prancing thing. And Vashti goes, no, I'm not coming. Now, we don't know why she said no. From historical data, there is an argument made that she may have very well been pregnant with the next king at this point because they worked out he became king at age 18 and he became king actually 18 years after this point. So it's very possible that she was pregnant and that she didn't want to run around prancing herself around in her pregnant state. Do we know that for sure? No. But what we do know is whatever her reasoning is, she decided to tell the king no. Not the greatest idea on the planet. So the king does what any good king would do. It says in verse 13, since it was customary for the king to consult experts in the matter of law and justice, he spoke with the wise men who understood the times. So scenes unfolding. The queen doesn't come. The king talks to the guys. Here's what the guys tell the king. Look, here's the problem, king. As soon as our wives find out that she said no to you, they're going to start saying no to us. And then when they start saying no to us, then all the wives in the palace are going to start figuring out that they can say no to their husbands. And then once that happens and word gets out into the real people world, all those wives are going to say no to those husbands, and we will lose the world. Now, that's my translation, but that's basically what they say. This is going to become a girl's pink world, and we got to put a stop to it right here, right now, while we can. And very simply put, it says here in verse 21, the king and his nobles were pleased with this advice. I love that. You know, I agree. Those women taking over the world. We're putting a stop to this right now. And so this is what they tell him. They say, look, you need to make sure that people understand they can't do this, woman in particular. So tell Vashti, since she decided to not want to come see you, she can never see you again. And he goes, that's it, decreed. She can never see me again. Now, if you're the husband and she's the wife and you say that, it creates certain problems for both parties, right? So suddenly he goes, wow, okay, she's been decreed, and off they go. Now, we start here. Check this out. In chapter 2, it says, later, when the anger of the king Xerxes had subsided, he remembered Vashti and what she had done and what he had decreed about her. I've heard messages on this verse about the king being so drunk the night before that he woke up the next morning and suddenly remembered all this and went, whoa, what have I done? But the reality is that doesn't make any sense, does it? I mean, that the king would wake up the next morning and go, oh, did I banish her? Wow, that's kind of weird. And I remember what she did. Here's what happens. Between chapter 1 and chapter 2, 4 years takes place. What 4 years takes place between those two chapters? The 4 years of battle with the Grecian Empire. See, at the point that he banishes Vashti, the next 4 years, they go straight into a campaign. He gets back from that, and it says later, once his anger had subsided and he was done, he remembered what Vashti had done and what he had done. And so now he realizes, I'm back and we're in trouble because I don't have a wife, at least not one that can come see me. And so the guys sit around again and say, I tell you what, here's what we do. We go into the kingdom. We find all of the beautiful virgins in the kingdom. We bring them together for you. You pick one, it'll be great. So we jump to the next scene, okay? While all this is unfolding and the Grecian Empire is being attacked by the Persians and Vashti's been, she's in the temple, but she can't see the king. In the meantime, over here we have a man named Mordecai, and he is raising a beautiful young woman named Hadassi, who is also known as Esther. Esther is her Babylonian name. And they are functioning within the Persian Empire in a manner that fits right in. There is actually an old institution in the Iranian culture, which goes back to the Jewish culture, called the kitman, where you were allowed to basically hide your faith if your life was going to be in danger or it was going to endanger you in some way. And so you find this whole system here, what the historians believe was part of the kitman system, where Mordecai tells Esther, do not reveal your identity as a Jewish person to anyone, because if you do, you will function at a sub-level at that point. So just stick with the whole Persian thing. Well, it turns out while Mordecai is raising her, she becomes one of these women that they come out and choose, and they select her among a number of other women. Mordecai, we find out, sits at the gate of the king, which in Hebrew terms translates into the fact that Mordecai was basically a station at the gate. It turns out, because of the amount of information Mordecai knew about everything, that it is very likely he was in high position, possibly in the secret service of the king. But he was without a doubt not lazily sitting around at the gate, but he was posted there in a position of authority. He also was able to check on Esther a lot, so we know that. So all this is unfolding, right? We got Mordecai and Esther raising up. We got the king here saying, find virgins. They come, they take Esther, they take her back. Now we find out here, in chapter 2, what happens? In verse 8 of chapter 2, it says, when the king's order and edict had been proclaimed, many girls were brought to the citadel of Susa, that's the winter temple of the kings of Persia, and put under the care of Hegai. Esther was also taken to the king's palace and entrusted to Hegai, who had charge over the harem. The girl pleased him and won his favor. Immediately, he provided her with beauty treatments and special food. He assigned to her 7 maids selected from the king's palace and moved her and her maids into the best palace in the harem. So here's what's happening. As this scene unfolds, Esther's brought into a harem. A harem is a strange thing because they'll go out, they'll get all these women, they'll bring them into the harem. Once they're in the king's harem, they can never leave the king's harem. It's not like you get to be picked as queen and the rest of the, okay, you can all go home now, thank you for playing. What you end up doing is you live in the harem and you are available to the king whenever he is in the mood. And you sit there in the harem, and the queen, whichever one was selected, she gets to live a life as a queen. The rest get to live a life as a harem. Now, for many young women, the harem would have been a better life in that palace than even the life they would have lived out in Persian streets. But here in the harem, for someone like Esther, who was well cared for by her uncle Mordecai, this was not where she wanted to be. I can imagine in this scene how difficult it must have been for Esther in among all these women that are fighting to try to win the queen, the position of queen, and she just wants to go home. But because of her incredible depths of character and the way about her, she wins the heart of the guy watching over them, and he sets her apart. Then it says, as she's presented after 12 months, because it tells us here in chapter 2, for 12 months, they got beauty treatments and training and stuff before they presented them to the nobles and the king. She was presented to everybody, and it said she won everybody over above all the other women. Not just because of her physical beauty, but because of her way. You ever met someone like that? That their way about them just wins you over? You're just like, wow, this is a cool person. Well, it turns out, when she meets with the king, it says here in verse 15 of chapter 2, when the turn came for Esther, the girl Mordecai had adopted, to go to the king, she asked for nothing other than what Haggai, the king's eunuch, who was in charge of the harem, suggested. And Esther won the favor of everyone who saw her. She was taken to King Xerxes in the royal residence in the 10th month, the 10th of Tebeth, in the 7th year of his reign. This is 4 years after the book opened, in the 3rd year of his reign. And now we're right smack dab where we need to be. Now the king was attracted to Esther more than any of the other women, and she won his favor and approval more than any of the other virgins. Well, she turns out to become queen. Isn't that cool? So here she is, queen. Now all of us go, yay, Esther won! But the reality is we've missed a certain part of it. Esther was pulled out of her home where she was a perfectly happy little Jewish girl, and she's stuck in the temple as the queen of Persia now, and she has to hide her identity as a Jew because her uncle says, hide it, and there she lives. That's the life she lives. Now, I don't know what Esther was thinking during all this, but I can tell you, for some people, that would have been their dream. For Esther, that might have been a very difficult place to be. And if you were living her scene, her world, her life, I wonder how many times you would need to ask God, what are you doing? What are you doing? I thought you loved me. And now I'm a harem in a temple, in a palace for a king, and now I'm a queen and I have to do his bidding. In the meantime, Mordecai, sitting at the guard's gates, overhears a plot that's being developed to kill the king. So now we jump into another scene. Mordecai hears about the plot, and so he goes to Esther and he tells Esther about the plot that's developing over here. And Esther goes to the king in the appropriate time and says, King, we heard about a plot through Mordecai. They're going to try to kill you. They investigate. They find out it to be true. They kill the two guys that were trying to kill the king. And everybody's happy and it gets chronicled. We're told by the historian Herodotus, who was a great historian back then, we're told by him that it is likely that at the time of somebody like Mordecai doing this for the king, he would have been made benefactor of the king. And being made benefactor of the king, because whenever somebody rescued the king's life, they were made benefactor of the king, that meant that they would only have to bow down or prostrate themselves before the king himself, nobody else. The reason I bring that up is because the next part of the story gets a little weird if you don't know that. See, there's this guy, Haman, who's brought to power by the king. He, unlike Mordecai and Esther, who by their character and their nature are working their way up like a Daniel might have, he, on the other hand, is one of those people that's power hungry and manipulating his way through the system, and he gets into the system and he gets high up in the system. And he becomes so power hungry that he starts wanting everybody to think of him like they think of the king. Pride grabs a hold of his heart. And at one point, he's doing his thing, and Mordecai does not bow down to him. Now, it would seem odd, wouldn't it? If Mordecai, who's the man that's telling his niece, keep your identity secret. He goes by his Babylonian name, Mordecai, and he functions within the Babylonian system. And suddenly now, as a guy comes by the street, he's jumping up in a crowd, bowing down and saying, I will not bow down. It just doesn't fit, does it? But if Mordecai had been made benefactor of the king and he didn't have to bow down and he was given permission in essence by the king now that you don't have to bow down to anybody other than me, then it makes sense that you take that as a man of God and say, I don't have to bow down, I'm not bowing down. Kitman doesn't exactly apply, does it? Because your life's not in danger because you don't have to bow down. So he doesn't bow down to Haman and Haman gets mad. And he goes back to his wife and he says, this guy won't bow down, but he gets more mad. Have you ever been in one of those positions where you're mad about one thing and it's kind of a small deal and by the next day you're madder than you were? And then by 2 days later you've thought about it and kind of mulled over and you're like, that person really, I hate him. And then like 5 days later you're plotting to try to kill them. And of course you've never done that. Of course you've never had those feelings. I've never had them, but hypothetically, let's just say I had or you had. Then that's exactly the journey that Haman goes on. You see, it starts off that he's mad at Mordecai, but he wants more. I don't want to hurt Mordecai. I want to hurt his family. Forget his family. I want to hurt his people because I found out he's Jewish. So he plots this whole thing that he's going to get the Jewish people killed by doing this. He goes to the king and says to the king, here's what I want you to do. I want you to write a decree that these Jewish people who are kind of a plague to the system, that we don't want to do anything mean to them. What we want to just do is tell other people, if you want to take their stuff or you want to kill them on this particular day, you can do that without consequence. How would you like it if you found out as you're walking out here, you got to the door and I was standing there and I said, by the way, just so you know, on Friday, anyone in the greater Orlando area can come into the house of any person who calls Mosaic their home, kill them and steal their stuff without consequence. Now, you can't do anything about it. Just hope that they don't find out that you're one of the Mosaicans. That would be a pretty bad deal, wouldn't it? And this is what Mordecai finds out. And so he goes to Esther and he says to Esther, listen, we are in trouble. In chapter 4, it says this. After he'd sent word to Esther that she needs to talk to the king, in verse 9, it says, Hatak went back to and reported to Esther what Mordecai had said. Then she instructed him to say to Mordecai, all the king's officials and the people of the royal provinces know that for any man or woman who approaches the king in the inner court without being summoned, the king has but one law, that he be put to death. The only exception to this is for the king to extend the gold scepter to him and spare his life. But 30 days have passed since I have been called to the king. Esther simply says, Mordecai, I hear you. But I just want to, just in case you didn't know, if I approach the king without permission, the only option is death, unless the king chooses to hold his scepter out, which is the only option for life. And side note, I may not be in the highest favor with the king right now because he hasn't called for me for 30 days. And Mordecai replies to her this way. When Esther's words were reported to Mordecai, verse 12, he sent back his answer. Do not think that because you are in the king's house, you alone of all the Jews will escape. For if you remain silent at this time, relief and deliverance for the Jews will arise from another place. But you and your family, father's family, will perish. And who knows but that you have come to royal position for such a time as this? Then Esther sent this reply to Mordecai. Go gather together all the Jews who are in Susa and fast for me. Do not eat or drink for 3 days, night or day. I and my maids will fast with you, as you do. When this is done, I will go to the king, even though it is against the law, and if I perish, I perish. Now that's the part of the story we all kind of know, and it's this beautiful part of the story. But while this scene is all happening, while Mordecai's talking to Esther, and they're like, oh my gosh, we've got to do this, we're going to rescue, I don't know how it's going to happen. Esther's scared, Mordecai's telling her, go. At the same time, another scene is unfolding here, because Haman is on a warpath. See, he walks by, and Esther goes to the king and says, I'd like to throw a banquet for you and Haman. Can we talk? It would please me if it pleases the king. And the king goes, sure. And he contacts Haman. Hey, Haman. Haman didn't pick up his cell, so he had to call him on the regular line. Haman, what's going on? Listen, Esther wants us at a banquet. And Haman's so excited. He goes to his wife. He's like, oh my gosh, I'm so important. You're not going to believe it. The queen invited just me and the king together. That's his scene while Esther's scene's happening over here. And Haman, as he's walking past the gate, Mordecai's standing there. Mordecai doesn't acknowledge him again. So Haman gets so mad, he goes to his wife and he's like, I hate this man. I don't just want to kill the Jews. I want to kill him. So he kind of went backwards this time. So she says, well, listen, if he's going to show you no respect, here's what you do. You build a huge gallows where you can go and hang him. And we'll figure out a plan to tell the king to hang Mordecai. So they go and build the gallows. They're like, he literally announces and says, go and build the gallows. We're going to do that. And just while that scene's taking place, at the same time, that night, the king is in bed and he can't sleep. So he's hanging out and he's like, oh, I can't sleep. Can somebody read me the Chronicles? Now, there's only two reasons why you'd read the Chronicles of the Kings. One, because they're so boring that they'll put you to sleep. Or the king wanted to hear another story about himself. Pick a good one, not the Grecian Empire one, something else, please. You want to hear the story about when you were rescued from that evil plot? Ooh, that one sounds good. So he starts reading, and they get to the part where Mordecai is the one that told him about the plot. And the king gets up, and he's like, wait a second. Did we ever honor Mordecai? Well, you know, the usual deal. Somebody that rescues you, you got the... Did we ever publicly honor him? No, we didn't. Well, we need to do something about that. So he calls Haman, and he wakes him up. Haman, come over here. Haman comes in the court. He goes, listen, I got a question for you. Let's say there's somebody in the kingdom that I totally love, and I totally want to honor him. How would you do it? And Haman goes, oh, I know he's talking about me. So Haman's like, okay, here's what I would do. I'd put your robe over me. I mean him. And I would put him on your horse that nobody gets to ride, and then I would have him go through the streets tomorrow and have some poor guy leading him in front of the horse going, this is the man the king favors most. And the king goes, that's a fantastic idea. I mean, Haman must have been like, yes! And he goes, here's what I want you to do. Tomorrow morning, I want you to find Mordecai, put him on the horse with the thing, and I want you to lead him. I mean, it's like watching a beautiful movie. You're like, yes! And that's what happens. Through the streets. This is the man the king favors most. After he's done with that, listen to this, it gets even funnier. He goes back to his wife in tears. Honey, you won't believe what happened. It's a Mordecai on the horse and I was leading. It was terrible. And she looks at him and she goes, you know what? Mordecai is far too powerful. Now the whole plan we had with the Jewish people and Mordecai and stuff, we should cut it off right now because it's going to get you in deep trouble when they find out. That's never good when you're like right in the middle of it and you're like, what do you mean kill the plan? I've already built the gallows. What am I going to tell them? Well, we'll figure it out. And while they're in the conversation, literally, a eunuch comes and says, the banquet's starting. You should go. He gets himself all dressed and put together, goes to the banquet. And at that banquet, he sits there and Esther says to the king, King, just so you know, I'm Jewish. Can you imagine Haman's surprise? The queen is Jewish. That's definitely a problem. And then when the queen says, so that decree you put out about killing the Jews, that includes me, which means that they should be able to attack me. And just so you know, in case you weren't aware, it was Haman's idea. And here's why he did it. Because he was mad at Mordecai, the one you honored this morning. Excuse me, I need to go to the bathroom. Not today, Haman. They take Haman, they hang him on the same gallows he built for Mordecai. Isn't that amazing? The king decrees, okay, I can't change the decree. People can attack the Jewish people, but any Jewish people being attacked can defend themselves with whatever weapons they want. They can kill anyone attacking them, and if they kill anyone attacking them and defend their stuff that day, they will not be held responsible for those deaths. So now, if you want to take the Jewish people's stuff, you got to decide, am I bigger than him? Is it worth it? That day went by uneventful. And there's a Jewish ceremony that they established to remember that day that lasted forever. It was amazing. Mordecai was made second in command of the kingdom. Esther lived happily ever after as the Persian queen. Xerxes her king. And everything turned out beautifully. And yet, as the story unfolded, so many scenes were happening that didn't seem so beautiful at the time, did they? But somehow God was watching and knowing and working everything out. The New Testament tells us that God is at work in us, bringing to completion the work he began in us. The New Testament tells us he works all things out for those who love him and are called according to his purpose, for his people. And here in the Old Testament, we see a picture of a young woman and a king and a queen and all these things happening and a guard and an uncle and a mean man, a perfect movie unfolding and God watching all the scenes and incorporating them. In these scenes, we have a queen who ultimately was called by a king to come before people when she didn't want to, and she made a decision. That decision had a consequence, And that consequence affected things in such a huge way that it affected a young woman who lived in a village with her uncle, who was brought then into the palace to become a harem. And because of her character and what she had become all those years growing up, her character brought her forth in influence to become the queen. And then as queen, her uncle, who had become the head of the secret service in that area, or at least a high position, that influence impacted his ability to bring information to the queen, which gave her favor and him favor, which then thwarted the plan of Haman, which then brought everything around in perfect harmony to the saving of the Jewish people. Because at the time, when Mordecai said to the queen, it is possible that all this is happening for such a time as this. We always hear that phrase, but you know, Mordecai could have made that about any person in history. See, I don't know who you are here today. I don't know who you are. Maybe you're a giant, a dwarf, maybe you're a wizard, maybe you're a mermaid. I don't know. It doesn't really matter, actually, because whatever you are, God made you just that way. You know that God could have placed you anywhere in history? Anywhere in history. He could have placed you on any continent, in any village, in any family. He could have given you any job. He could have given you any friends. He could have placed you in any circumstance. But he placed you here and now. And he didn't do it by accident. He did it because in his story of history, your story matters. What you do, just like the queen, the decisions you make, they have impact and they matter. And what you do today and tomorrow and Wednesday and Friday, it will matter. It will matter. What you say will matter because people are listening. The king listened to his wise counsel. You speak into somebody's life and they're listening. What you say matters. Who you listen to matters. Because people will speak into your life, and if you listen to them and they're the wrong people, you'll do the wrong things. It matters. It matters how you live. I think the greatest gift that we can give humanity and the greatest work we can do for God's kingdom is to be men and women of integrity and authenticity. To live God's way and to do it for real. To get out there every day and do it. You know that band that just played for us? I love how they came up with their name, Living Anthem, right? Remember what he said? He said on Tuesday when we're hanging out and people are watching our lives, I want them to go, now there's a living anthem, a living hymn of praise to God. What a beautiful picture of how we should live our lives, isn't it? Monday morning in the office, Wednesday afternoon with not much to do, Friday night, Sunday morning, it should all look the same. You and I should live our lives as men and women who love Jesus and follow him and believe that if he says to do it a certain way, we do it. And as we live our lives that way, it doesn't matter who you are. God is at work in the scenes around you and in his story. And as he works in those scenes, he's going to bring your story right into where it needs to fit. If you feel like a mermaid sometimes, like in God's world you don't fit, or you can't find your place, or you don't know how God's made you or designed you, know this. Don't go and stand in a corner somewhere. Don't go get out of the game. Walk over, put your hand in somebody else's hand, and say, where did the mermaids go? And I promise you, because the God's word says it, God has a place for you on this planet, and you're right in it right now. And instead of living thinking you've missed it, live this week like you're right in the middle of it, because you are. May your life be a poem to the story of God. Remember Ephesians 2:10, you are God's workmanship or poem, and he has prepared a set of good works just for you. They're waiting for you this week. Go do them. And as you do, your story will matter just as much as it always has. God will remind you of that. I'm so glad my story matters. I'm so glad yours does. I'm so glad that God has made me who I am. I pray you would be too, because he's made you for such a time as this.